Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Good evening and welcome to Amplify, a telephone talk show that looks at life from a religious perspective. I'm Father Ron Lingwin, hoping that you have felt the warmth of God's love in your life this day, but especially the joy you feel when you share God's love with others. I'd like to begin our program, as we do each week, with a story that is based on faith and formed with imagination. Jesus sat and talked with a group of children. One by one, each of their parents came forward to speak with Jesus to ask him a question. A rich man wearing fine robes said, "Master, when my wife said to me, 'Let the children go to hear him, for he truly is a source of inspiration. Let the children hear what he has to say about the Father's love.' I was angry and replied, 'Do we not teach love for the Father in the temple?' My wife was not swayed by my words and got the children ready, who hurried to hear you. 'I have stood by a tree listening to your words, and now I must ask you, Master, how can I inspire my children to love God?'" Jesus sat and did not say anything for a moment, and then answered, "Whether you are a parent or not, you teach children by your example. The love of God can be found in nature. It can also be found in a child's innocence or a child's questions. The love of God can be found in the wisdom of the old. The wisdom and love of God can be found in parents as they raise a child. I tell you this, be a teacher to your children. Be firm, but just, loving, and caring. To all you are related to, and those who simply pass you by. Then your children will learn from your example, and they will teach their children and their children's children in the same way." Then Jesus extended his hand, blessed the children, and said, "My friends, my little friends, go in peace, and remember my words, for they are the words of the Father. May his love shine upon you, and may you be blessed and accomplish your purpose in life." A story of faith and imagination. And our guest this evening writes in the introduction to her book titled, "Don't Let the Culture Raise Your Kids." When I was growing up, the culture might not have been explicitly Christian, but it didn't actively work against Christian morality and values either. Today it does. If Christian parents want to stop this trend, especially before it gets worse, they need to think and act differently. Unfortunately, modern parents are often ill-equipped to do this because it isn't only children who are negatively influenced by the culture. Parents are too. It's easy to feel alone and insecure when you're the only parent setting limits on screen time, or refusing to buy the latest tech gadget, or pulling your child out of sex ed class. It's easy to feel like the quote-unquote bad guy when other parents are acting like their children's friends. For both parents and children, the culture onslaughts are pervasive. Educators take it upon themselves to school students in culturally correct notions of gender, sex, and marriage. The click of a mouse or the touch of a smartphone can expose children to obscene pornographic images. The entertainment and advertising industries seem hell-bent on destroying childhood innocence and ramping up a propensity for materialism, to say nothing of promiscuity. With the pervasiveness of technology and social media, peers often replace parents as the primary influence in a child's life. Our goal as Christian parents is to guide our children toward heaven. That's not where they'll be directed if we let the culture raise our kids. Our guest is Marcia Siegelstein. She has covered family issues for more than 25 years as a producer for CBS News and as a columnist. She has written for Fox News, First Things, World Magazine, and National Catholic Register, and Touchstone, and is a senior editor for Salvo Magazine. Marcia is a graduate of Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. She and her husband have two, quote-unquote, 20-something children. She states that this book is for those who have made the decision to raise their children as faithful Christians. Marcia, welcome back, or welcome to Amplify.
Thank you so much, Father. Thank you for having me.
It's probably revealed in, is answered in your introductory remarks that I've just read, but what do you hope to accomplish through this book?
I guess I want to open the eyes of parents who are trying to raise their children as faithful Christians, faithful Catholics, to the barriers that their children will encounter, to the barriers that they themselves as parents will encounter, to the difficulties that they will have in trying to do this. I didn't write the book from a personal point of view. I wrote it from based on my experience as a journalist and as a writer. But as I say, I think in the introduction, I probably wouldn't have written it if I weren't a parent. Mm-hmm. I learned oftentimes the hard way about how corrupt the culture is, how accessible that corrupt culture is to children and to my children. And the more I wrote about these things, the more I wanted to sort of put all that I had learned in one place so that parents can go into parenting with their eyes open to how the world will work against their efforts mm-hmm. to instill faith in their children.
Did your own children, raising your own children, have some influence on writing this book? And were there ways in which they surprised you while you were raising them?
Definitely, absolutely. And yes, first of all, I have two 20-something children. They are very, very different. And so I think that's an important lesson to have. But I also want to make it clear that this book is it's not a book about how to raise your children. I've read those books and I've benefited mm-hmm. from them. But I made way too many mistakes to write that kind of a book. It's not about my mistakes and it's not about what I did right. It's not a book about how to raise your kids. It's a book about here's what you need to know about the world if you're going to try to raise your children as faithful Catholics or faithful Christians. As I say somewhere in there, I think in the intro again, it's the book I wish I'd had when I became a parent. I think we all start out as parents thinking we can protect our kids from the world. And of course we do that to some degree, and we do it particularly when they're small and when their world is limited maybe to us and their immediate family. But the world is a scary place for children, and getting back to, you know, the quote that you just referred to where I say the culture when I grew up wasn't openly Christian, but it didn't work against, you know, the Christian faith that my parents were trying to instill in me. But today it really does. I mean, I think that people aren't aware of how easily our children can be affected by the culture in all kinds of ways. And that, you know, I talk about in the book the different chapters that I have, consumerism, education, things kids will encounter in schools. Media is a huge issue. The culture has become it's a corrupt culture. And I'm not saying that the culture when I was growing up or in any generation has been perfect or not corrupt, but just think about the culture that we live in today. We live in a culture that basically condones abortion, that mocks chastity, right? Embraces gender fluidity, gets you in trouble if you don't embrace those things, devalues marriage. We live in a culture where you have to define what you mean by marriage these days. So the culture is really very corrupt. And it's also, it's becoming anti-Christian. I mean, and of course we read this in the news all the time, people who are bakers who don't want to bake cakes for same-sex weddings and things like that, who are fined and whatnot. So it's just important, I think, for parents to go into parenting with their eyes wide open to what the world is going to tell their kids about how to be, and versus how they want their children to understand the world. It's a difficult time to be a parent. It probably has never been an easy time, but I think it is a particularly difficult time for a number of reasons. One issue that I talk about in my first chapter is sort of the culture of parenting. We live in a time when parents are sort of encouraged to be their children's friends, to be their pals. We live in a time when discipline has almost become a sort of a dirty word. We live in a time when you don't really hear the word authority figure and parent in the same sentence too much. That all contributes to the issue. Kids need to be led, and if kids aren't born knowing what's good, what's bad, what's right and wrong, what's good for them, bad for them, so it's our job as parents to tell them those things. It's our job, particularly as Catholic parents, to do that. And so the first thing that we as parents need to do is sort of realize that and sort of step up to the plate and be parents. The right kind of authority figure. Even the word authority sort of has a negative connotation these days, and that's unfortunate. We need to be, as parents, authoritative with our kids. If they don't listen to us, if they don't respect us, we can't really expect them to grow up, respecting God or believing that anybody's in charge of them, can we?
No, part of what you've been saying to us then is that Christian parents feel like they're swimming against the tide, that the role of parents has been changing, and that parents must become confident and authoritative parents, which means simply to be in charge, and that certainly authority is the foundation of the family and society. But you want us to understand, and why is it that parents shouldn't try to behave like therapists with their children?
Yes, yes. Yeah, one of my favorite authors who I quote in the book, and the book is heavily footnoted, so if people, want to follow up on a particular issue, there are resources and books and links and all that in the back. One of my favorite authors I quote extensively in the book is a guy named Bill Doherty. He's a therapist. He works at the University of Minnesota. Great guy, written a number of great books, and he talks about this issue of one thing he calls timid parent syndrome, parents afraid to be parents, and that parents have come to, as you put it, think of themselves as therapists, this therapeutic parenting. Well, we have to find out, your child swears at you or something, and your reaction is, I must try to figure out why they did that, instead of, you may not do that, that's wrong, go to your room, or whatever, the punishment's going to be, whatever the discipline is going to be. It's not that we shouldn't be concerned about our children's psyches, but we also have to, just step up and be parents. He's got a number of great stories in his books. Oh, he tells one about a little girl whose mother is dropping her off at nursery school one day, and the little girl takes off her coat, hands it to her mother, and says, "Hang up my coat." And the mother you know, hands it back and says, no, you do it yourself. And the teacher came up to the mother later that day and said, you are the first parent who handled it that way. And it was clear that that child had seen other children doing that and other parents just acceding to that demand, you know. And part of that is this sort of idea where, you know, speaking of this culture of parenting, that we almost see ourselves as our children's servants. And, of course, we are to some degree. We cook for them and whatnot. You know, we hanging up your child's coat, you know, that's kind of ridiculous. But it's a common thing. It's representative of a larger issue. We're afraid to instruct our children. We're afraid to make rules. And that does make it very tough for parents, this culture of parenting, because I don't want to get ahead of myself here, but parents feel peer pressure the same way that children do, too. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, that mother at that nursery school who didn't hang up her daughter's coat and said, no, you hang it up yourself. I could imagine if she had seen a bunch of other mothers just doing it, maybe she would have felt self-conscious or something, sort of standing up to her daughter's demand. Maybe she would have felt uncomfortable and she would have done it herself. So that culture of parenting affects us as parents in all kinds of ways. We feel pressure to behave like our children's friends sometimes. Other stories in my book, I talk about, you know, one father witnessing his a little girl at a soccer game, you know, kicking the umpire because he had called her out, and no one said anything to the child, not the parent, not the umpire. At the end of the game, she got her, you know, certificate of participation, like they all did. That's, you know, that's not a healthy thing. It's not good for children. It doesn't help them.
And so, caution, letting the kids decide is wrong in and of itself, because sometimes the problem is that winning their children's love and affection becomes the primary focus of children's.
Yes, yes, definitely. Right. Letting the kids decide. That phrase reminds me of another one of my favorite authors who I quote in the book, a guy named Dr. Leonard Sachs. He is a pediatrician and a psychologist, written so many great books on this topic. And that's kind of one of his favorite topics, is that we have become, he's studied parenting cultures around the world. He thinks that in the U.S. in particular, we've come to this notion, come to sort of accept this notion of letting the kids decide. Which is just, you know, it's absurd if you think about it, because, you know, a baby is born and grows up and imitates people and learns. They're not born knowing things, how to do things or what to do or how to be kind or whether they should be kind or, you know, what they should believe. No one's born knowing all of those things. But if no one directs and guides them, and that's the whole point of my book, if no one directs and guides them, then they'll just absorb whatever the world, you know, whatever they happen to come across in the world, what they come across online or what their friends are doing, what they see in movies, what they read in books, good heavens, what they see on social media. So that's the scary part, is that they will absorb these things from the world outside them, from the culture, and they won't be guided toward heaven. It's highly unlikely that they would be. You know, there are so many forces working against that in this day and age. And so parents just need to step up to the plate. They need to be unafraid to say, I'm going to be the parent. I'm going to try to do the best to teach my child right from wrong, to love God. Here's how we worship. This is how we live our lives. The idea that a child could figure that out, you know, on their own is crazy. So we need to sort of reverse that trend.
And you write that when the child is between 12 and 15 months old, it's time for transition, that it's no longer their job to keep their child happy all the time, that parents must be prepared to say no and to expect their child to be disappointed, frustrated, and unhappy. And when that does happen, the child has to start problem solving and thinking creatively, and they begin to learn diligence, self-reliance, and patience to their children. And so in terms of rulemaking, going back to Dr. Sachs, who you mentioned, don't ask children to follow rules. Tell them, don't negotiate. And then there are a series of rulemakings that all children need structure in their lives. And the best way to do this is to establish clear rules and limits. Be sure to establish rules that, quote unquote, make sense, that are appropriate to your child's age, and that are flexible enough to change as your child matures. Be firm in making your children keep the rules that have been appropriately set. So we're going to take this first break with Marcia Segelstein, her book, Don't Let the Culture Raise Your Kids. Welcome back to Amplify, where our guest is Marcia Segelstein. We're talking about her book titled Don't Let the Culture Raise Your Kids. Marcia, I should say that in every chapter you offer solutions, tips, and tools to help people. But even before that, you have a teaching toolbox in which you make these recommendations, assign chores, establish rituals, have family dinners, take family vacations, nurture extended family relationships, build a community, expect respect, make a family mission statement, have family meetings. Just select one or two. We could spend the rest of the program just talking about the teaching toolbox, but select one or two just to give an example of what it is that you're offering through this book in the teaching toolbox, but then also in the solutions, tips, and tools.
Yes. Yes. No, thanks for mentioning that, because the book is not just about here are the problems in the world and here are the difficulties parents are going to have raising faithful children. But the point of the book is here are the problems, but the real point is here are the solutions. Here's what you can do. And there are solutions and there are answers. So thank you for mentioning that. I try to devote as much time on the solutions, tips and tools as I do on the problems. You have the teaching toolbox, and discipline, and, one of my sources for this was a pediatrician, Dr. Jane Anderson, and she has some great tips about, on the subject of discipline. Again, we've talked about the fact that discipline has almost become a dirty word in our culture, but it's important for parents to think ahead of time about how they're going to discipline. And she also pointed out to me, Dr. Anderson, that the word discipline comes from the word that means to disciple. So it's not a bad thing. It has bad connotations, but all it is a means of what are you going to do when your children are disrespectful or when they don't do what you tell them to do? And so she's saying just to be prepared. Have your teaching toolbox ready. Know what you're going to do. If you're going to use a timeout, for example, as a disciplinary tool, assign a chair or a pillow or something like that as the timeout pillow or the timeout chair. She has parents who will even bring it into the pediatrician's office, her office, when they come with their children, so that if their children misbehave or don't listen, they always have that with them, that tool with them. If you plan in advance what you're going to do, you should never discipline in anger. But if you know in advance what you're going to do as a parent, you will be less frustrated. You'll be less angry. You will be able to take whatever measures you deem necessary in a calm, forthright manner. No, you may not do that. Sit in your timeout chair for 3 minutes or 5 minutes, whatever it is, depending on the child's age. So that's what she's talking about when she talks about a teaching toolbox. Another thing, another pediatrician told me is that it's never too late to start. If you feel that you have kind of been messing up when it comes to this, being too lax or too lenient, this pediatrician told me it's never too late to change direction and take charge. He even suggested to me that parents, could discuss it openly with their children and say, look, we've been making some mistakes. We have not been, you know, strict enough about certain things. So we're going to change direction, and this is how it's going to be. And he said you can expect a week or so of difficulty, and after that, things probably shall get better. Right, you mentioned rules. Rules being clear and age-appropriate. And people hear rules, they think, oh, that sounds so tough. But rules, I mean, and what my source for this is a guy named Dr. Thomas Lacona. He's a wonderful guy, author of many books, super books on raising kids, wonderful Catholic grandfather and father. And so he, his latest book is called How to Raise Kind Kids and Get Respect, Gratitude, and a Happier Family in the Bargain. So I see a lot of his stuff, footnoted, of course, in my book. Some of his rules are things, simple things like don't interrupt. Say please when you like something and thank you when someone does something for you. Look at the person who's talking to you. Those are simple rules. They're not mean or harsh. You're going to raise kids who are, you know, better human beings as a result of those rules. Another idea from him is having a family mission statement, and I love that idea. Mm-hmm. I wish I'd heard that idea when my kids were young enough to do it. He says make a family mission statement. Write it out on a board. Put it on the refrigerator. Hang it, frame it, put it in the kitchen. And he gave some examples in his book, and I quote them, of what such a family mission statement might be. It's to build family cohesiveness. You know, we're Smiths. This is what we're about, and these are some examples. We commit to being kind, honest, trustworthy, and fair. We, the Smiths, we don't lie, cheat, steal, or hurt someone on purpose. We commit to learning and growing in our faith through practice and trust in God's goodness, and we live with an attitude of gratitude and joy. I love that. Family mission statement. How wonderful. And you mentioned family dinners, I think. The research on the advantages to kids of having family dinners at least five times a week, it doesn't have to be family dinners, family meals, minimum five times a week, the advantages are huge. I mean, there have been tremendous studies done on this. Kids benefit in all kinds of ways, better family relationships, to say nothing of healthier eating, decreased drug and alcohol use by teens, just, you know, a healthier, stronger family. Mm-hmm. Another thing I write about is that, you know, dinner time is a chance for everybody to learn how to treat each other with respect, to listen, to say please and thank you. And it's also a time for parents to be able to share their values with their kids. And that's so important. We live in busy times. And so having those meals together can be crucial for having a loving, healthy family.
And it's real important then for parents to share values, because the values of the parents are not always those that are espoused in the schools they attend. And some parents are even excluded sometimes, yes, from what is happening. And you have an example of a student survey, which is incredible, the things that they're asking, yes, children to respond to. So when we talk about don't let the culture raise your kids, one of the concerns can be a school, can't it?
It can. Sadly, yes. Again, you know, just going back to my childhood, you know, my parents didn't have to worry when they sent me to public school. No teacher was going to tell me something that was in direct contradiction to what I learned in church. But today, that happens. Sadly, it really does. You know, the education establishment, as I write, has always been, for whatever reason, for a long time, has been dominated by progressive thinkers. But it's relatively recently that educators really have taken it upon themselves to really upend what parents are trying to teach their children, to sort of, as I write, attempt end runs around parents by imposing their beliefs on children that run contrary to their family's beliefs and certainly their religious beliefs. One of the things I focus on in the book in terms of schools, in my chapter on schools, is the issue of transgenderism and the issue of introducing that concept to children. And the reason I focus, that's not what I solely have in the chapter on schools, but I do put a lot of time into that issue because it is a looming issue. It is a big issue. It is, and it's a very dangerous trend at the moment. It's sort of the hot thing at the moment in schools. And you read of instance after instance of teachers, you know, taking it upon themselves, as early as kindergarten, in, say, for example, reading children books about transgenderism, telling children that they can be whatever sex they want to be. If they were born a boy, well, they don't have to stay a boy. And that is just tremendously dangerous. I mean, that is just a frightening concept to introduce to any child at any age, much less, you know, a five-year-old or a six-year-old. You might be astonished to go on Amazon and look under children's books and put in the subject of transgenderism, the number of books that come up, for kids really as young as three, picture books. It's scary. And, there's nothing, as I write, to stop a teacher, from having one of those books and reading it to your child, and you might not even know. You know, it used to be that sex ed was sort of the biggest worry, headache for parents when it came to schools, particularly public schools. And the trouble is that other issues like same-sex marriage or gender fluidity, transgenderism, can be woven into other lessons without parents knowing about it. There is not going to be a class on transgenderism. Maybe they'll, you know, talk about it during library time. That'll be the book that they choose to read the children. And this is happening at schools. And kids are coming home from schools, talking to their parents, and they're confused and they're upset. Parents, you know, don't have to be notified about this kind of thing, and that's what makes it scary. It's as though, you know, teachers take it upon themselves to say, well, we think your children should know about this. You may disagree. It may be against your religious beliefs, but it doesn't matter because we think it's right. And there's a real arrogance to that. So schools can be dangerous places for kids. I hate to say it, but it is true.
And my church and your church believe that parents have the first responsibility for the education of their children, and they're the first heralds of the faith for them. Now, you've been in you were in media for so many years,
yes.
And the media is also one of your concerns. You write that there's no question that digital media has become a dominant force, if not the dominant force, in the lives of young people. Its influence and potential influence cannot be underestimated. You write also, according to statistics compiled by the American College of Pediatricians, the average child spends about 7.5 hours a day using media. On a typical day, 8 to 18-year-olds spend about 4.5 hours watching television, 1.5 hours using computers, and less time on other media such as video games, books, magazines, and movies. Some studies put the figure even higher for older children and teens. It has become the leading activity for children and teens other than sleeping. That's a lot of time, a lot of content, and a huge opportunity for the world to exert its influence. There's so much you write here about the media, but try to give us a bit of an overview about your concern of that part of the culture raising our kids.
Yes. Yeah, I'd say media use and media concerns is probably uppermost in the minds of a lot of parents because it's difficult to know sometimes how to manage media. But as you say, just given the amount of time that most children, that the average child spends with media, you've just, as a parent, got to understand that that is going to have a big influence on them. And so managing media, the media that your child consumes, has got to be up there as one of your top priorities. And first, before I get into some specifics about media per se, I also just want to add that just spending too much time in front of screens has been found to be a risk factor for anxiety and depression. Just spending too much time in front of a screen, whether it's a cell phone or a tablet or a computer, can be a bad thing, particularly for adolescents. It sort of cuts them off from the world, from the real world, and from real interactions and real social interactions with other people. So cell phones, let's just take cell phones. Think of all the negative influences that reach kids on their cell phones. Pornography, sexting, overuse of social media, online bullying, peer pressure. That's frightening to think that just that small machine in your child's hand, a smartphone, can, cause so much danger, so much harm to your child. I quote another author in my book called she's a woman named Naomi Schaefer Riley, wonderful author, and she says it's not an exaggeration to say that giving your kids a cell phone is giving them the keys to the kingdom. And I thought that was so brilliant. It's true. You are saying, here's the world at your fingertips. You know, you can do whatever you want. So we need to figure out how to manage media. And not just media that kids consume, such as pornography and all that stuff, which is terrible, but also that connection with other teens and the influence that they exert over our kids because they're constantly texting or constantly on their phones. That means that increases the amount of peer pressure that kids already feel. So that's an important thing for parents to keep in mind. Peer pressure has been an issue for adolescents, you know, since the beginning of time, I'm sure. But it's just amped up to a huge degree because kids can see in real time, whether it's on Facebook or whatever, what their peers are doing, what they're wearing, what's cool, what's in, what's out. And so being yourself and sticking to what your parents tell you is right can be even more challenging for kids today because of media and because of technology. So, again, I try to focus on solutions and things that parents can do. When it comes to smartphones, there are a number of things that they can do. They should remember that they're the ones paying for these things. They're the ones paying for the computers, the tablets, the smartphones. And so this isn't from me. This is from pediatricians and psychologists. They say that parents should insist on knowing passwords and logins, and they should tell their children that they have the right to monitor their devices. Kids should know that parents may check on what they're doing online, and they should make it clear that having a phone is a privilege, not a right. And there are so many filters and monitoring devices that can be installed on kids' phones and computers, and parents should make use of them. In my book, I list a number of specific filters. Dr. Sachs, who I'd mentioned before, he has one that he particularly likes called Net Nanny. It allows parents to track every site that their kids visit. It lets the parents see the amount of time they're spending online. So filters are just a great tool for parents to use. And it's amazing to me how few parents realize that there are filters that they can buy, and they're not difficult to install. Again, I have a whole list in my book of highly recommended filtering and monitoring services for phones, computers, any device that's connected to the internet.
I would like to finish the quote of Naomi Riley. You began by her saying it's not an exaggeration to say that giving your kids the cell phone is giving them the keys to the kingdom. The rest, I think, summarizes in a whole lot that you write in this particular chapter. There is a whole world out there that they can now access without your knowledge. That world, which will be constantly beeping at your children, will forever change him or her. It may change how your child views friendships, how he or she interacts with the outdoors, how he or she experiences time alone. When we hand over phones and tablets to children, we are likely to be changing not only the information they can access, but also their habits, their personalities, and their tastes. And towards the end of this chapter, you write about silence, the importance mm-hmm. of silence. Say a little bit about that.
Yes. Yes. I think that's just a beautiful idea. The world is full of noise. Our phones are constantly beeping at us. Our computers are telling us when we have a new email. We're always getting text messages, instant messaging. We're getting Facebook notifications. The world is so much with us. And it's hard for adults and children to know who they are, to think about who they really are, what's really important, when they're constantly distracted. The world is a distracting place and probably always has been, but I think it's especially distracting thanks to technology in these times. And getting away from it all is important. Getting away from technology is an important thing. I've had people recommend, and I speak about this in the book, you know, for families to set aside a day of no technology, maybe Sunday afternoons or an evening or something. No phones, of course, no phones ever at the dinner table, but in general, no phones maybe for one day of the week. Make time for silence. It fosters the imagination. It lets you think about important things. It's good for your brain. It's good for your heart. It's good for your soul.
Yeah, and when you talk in the solutions, tips, and tools section for television and streaming services, you suggest know the shows, check the channels, watch together, explain commercials, limit TV time, record ahead of time, use blocking technology and parental controls, as you've already addressed, know what is being downloaded. For cell phones and other screens, be in charge, start with dumb phones, limit use, set a good example, use filters, as you've said, and quieting the noise. And you have quotes in here from Cardinal Robert Sarah, who says, nothing will make us discover God better than his silence inscribed in the center of our being. If we do not cultivate this silence, how can we find God? And Benedict XVI, we live in a society in which it seems that every space, every moment must be, quote-unquote, filled with projects, activities, and noise. There is often no time even to listen or to converse. Let us not fear to create silence within and outside ourselves if we wish to be able not only to become aware of God's voice, but also to make out the voice of the person beside us, the voices of others. We and our children are immersed in a noisy, media-filled world, and that can be hard to escape. But if we want our children to have a relationship with God, we must find ways of setting the world aside and cultivating silence. In silence, not in turmoil and noise, God enters into the innermost depths of our being. We're going to take this break. Welcome back to the second hour of Amplify, where our guest is Marcia Seckelstein. We're talking about her book, Don't Let the Culture Raise Your Kids, and we're exploring how indeed that might be happening. The next chapter we want to deal with is titled Sex. And she writes, as children, as Christian parents, we want our children to understand sex differently than the rest of the world. We want them to understand and affirm chastity, knowing why it's important. We want them to appreciate sex as a gift from God to be shared within the context of marriage. But maybe like many Christian parents, you think that's an almost impossible ideal. Without a doubt, this is an area where the world is going to work against you. I'm going to skip around here. Just imagine that an alien suddenly dropped into our world to find out what our society thinks about sex. He'd assume that everyone's doing it. There aren't any consequences, or none that anyone worries about ahead of time. That it's apparently enjoyable but not meaningful. That marriage has nothing to do with it. if it even come across the concept of marriage, that there's no moral component if it come across the concept of morality, and that there's no connection between sex and planning a family. If we let the world raise our kids, they too will end up believing what the alien would, that sex is purely an act of pleasure, without meaning or consequence, to be engaged in without restriction, except perhaps regarding the use of contraception. That's a far cry from the truth about sex according to the church. But of course, she writes later, the sad truth is that some young people never even hear what the church teaches about sex, and I would add to it, or anything. And then finally, in fact, a Harvard study estimates that more than 40% of parents don't talk to their children about sex, and for those who do, it's usually after the children have become sexually active. That says a lot about this chapter, but tell us a little bit about your concern about how sex can influence how we're raising our children.
Right. Well, you know, I think the you touched on it there, that I think a lot of Catholic and other Christian parents have maybe given up on the idea of teaching what the church teaches about sex. Living together is more common than not doing so, for example. I don't think the parents should give up on that idea. It's a pretty important concept. So first of all, just the idea that it's our responsibility to say that to our children is important. And if we don't, the world certainly isn't going to do that for us. So there was a survey done just years ago. I'm sure it's gotten worse since then. It's called the National Survey of Youth and Religion. Teenagers were asked, do you think people should wait to have sex until they're married or not necessarily? They divided the teenagers by religious affiliation. Of the Roman Catholic teenagers who were asked, only 51.2%, just a tiny bit over half, said yes, that people should wait to have sex. They're teenagers answering this question. So they haven't been told this, I presume. The whole world talks about sex. Movies are all about sex. Books are about sex. They can see sex on their iPhones. If we parents don't say, look, this is what sex is, this is the intent of sex, this is why God created sex, this is what it's for. It's for marriage. And explain it in those terms, the holiness of it, the sanctity of it. They're not going to have any idea that they're supposed to wait. They're not going to know. In the book, I tell this anecdote also. I met a young woman a few years ago. She was a teacher in a Catholic school here in my diocese. She was originally from South America. And she told me that her students didn't hide from her the fact that many of them were engaging in sexual activities. And when she told them that this was against the teaching of the church, she said they literally scoffed. They said, huh, what are you talking about? Maybe in your country, they said, but not here. Mm-hmm. These were kids in a Catholic high school. They didn't know that it was a teaching of the church. So that's the first thing. It's up to parents to say that to their kids, because they're not going to get that message from the culture. So first of all, that's the primary important thing, that the most important thing. It's up to parents to say that. From there on, it gets even trickier. So you can tell that to your kid, and then you're going to have to reinforce it in all kinds of ways. You're going to be up against, you know, what they learn in sex education in schools, and I go into this in this chapter, sex education, that is, I talk about it in this chapter. In most public schools teach what's called comprehensive sex ed. Basically, students are given a laundry list, a cafeteria list of how they can give and receive sexual pleasure. Contraception is covered. Abstinence is usually at least mentioned, but just as an option. excuse me. My favorite author on this topic is a doctor, a psychiatrist named Dr. Miriam Grossman, who's written excellent books on this topic. I think her first big book was called Unprotected. She was a psychiatrist who worked at UCLA, and she treated, she talks about how she treated college students there, many of whom were suffering as a result of the hookup culture. But she did a lot of research into how modern sex ed came to be and why it was implemented in the first place. And what she found was that it was followers of Dr. Alfred Kinsey, who is the now discredited sex researcher, unquote, unquote, an author. It was followers of him. They set out to change the attitudes of young people about sex. The goal had been up to that point in sex ed. The goal up to that point had been to keep kids safe and healthy. It was to promote but their goal changed. Now it was to promote a secular, amoral view of sex through sex education. So they started implementing this comprehensive sex ed, and that changed everything. Comprehensive sex ed, it goes against Christian teaching. It's saying, do whatever you want to do. Here are the fundamentals of it. Here's the physical aspect of it. And that's really all you need to know. So that's, you know, pretty terrifying, given the fact that, you know, the incidence of sexually transmitted diseases, is, you know, they're at astronomical numbers these days. Some of which they can't even be treated anymore with antibiotics. So we've let loose this sort of monster, in the form of sex education in our schools. Parents really need to be on top of that. They need to know what's going on in their schools, and they need to counter it to their children.
And you also write about how in some schools sex education isn't relegated to high school. There are guidelines that provide specific bullet points for sex educators working with children starting in kindergarten, for children between 5 and 8.
Yes.
And the list is unbelievable. I'm not sure we have a time to get into all of that, but they're pretty specific.
It's terrifying.
Both boys and girls have body parts that feel good when touched. A vaginal intercourse. Some people are homosexual. A family consists of two or more people who care for each other in many ways. Many people live in lifetime committed relationships, even though they may not be legally married. So it goes on and on. And with regard to solutions, tips, and tools, you recommend do your sex education homework, give your children the facts, be positive, explain why, and seek support. Let's move then to pornography in the interest of time. Again, the book is titled Don't Let the Culture Raise Your Kids. And you write in this chapter dealing with pornography, sex is everywhere. So it's no surprise that many teens and their parents have a no big deal, morally indifferent attitude about pornography. Some have a wink, nudge, boys will be boys attitude when it comes to porn. Others assume everybody looks at it. These are the sorts of attitudes our children are surrounded by and from which they need our protection. How do we do that?
Right. When it comes to porn, our children definitely need our protection. This is a huge, huge issue. Unfortunately, it doesn't just apply to kids, but it's what we're talking about today. There are a few things to touch on here. First is that pornography today is much more graphic than it ever has been in the past. And it's so accessible to kids. It is so easily accessible. If we don't put filters on phone or don't restrict our which websites our children can go on, if a child has access to an unfiltered smartphone, the kind of pornography that child could access is terrifying. It would be terrifying to most adults, I'm sure. Pornography use among kids is high. It's high among adults. So we need to think about this really, really carefully. One of the people I interviewed on this topic was a woman named Dr. Jill Manning. She's a therapist. She works a lot with kids and teens who have been exposed to pornography at a young age. And she has, you know, witnessed firsthand how that exposure has harmed them. Not just necessarily addiction. That is an issue, porn addiction. But it it changes their concepts of sex. And I'm going to read a short quote of hers. This is Dr. Jill Manning. She says, "I believe pornography is the most successfully marketed insult and attack on our divine nature as human beings that has ever existed. There's never been anything so calculated and widespread and so effective at reaching so many people at such a young age." That's from a woman who works with children who have seen pornography. So I think that's pretty, that's a wake-up call for us as parents. There are all kinds of negative effects that pornography have on kids. You know, I was just reading an article recently, just a couple of days ago, about the increase in abuse of teenage girls by their boyfriends because of what they see, what these kids see in pornographic videos. So there are all kinds of issues looming when it comes to this. And again, like sex, like when we talked before about the fact that it's up to parents to tell our children that what the church says about sex, that many kids literally have never been told that the church says this as opposed to what the world says, that the church actually also says viewing pornography is wrong, according to the church. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops has a pastoral letter, a letter written in 2015 called "Create in Me a Clean Heart," and it clearly states that producing or using pornography is gravely wrong. It's a grave matter by its object, and it goes on. So that's clear. We need to talk to our kids about what pornography is at the appropriate age. But we need to talk to them about what it is, because another issue with pornography is that kids often stumble upon it accidentally. They can come across it by clicking on the wrong link in an email. They can be shown pornography by their friends at a friend's house or on their friend's phone. Some websites have names that are kid sort of friendly names that are similar to kids' toys and things like that, but they turn out to be pornography sites. So some kids do seek it out intentionally. Some kids come across it accidentally. So it's up to parents to talk to their kids about it and to do everything they can to protect their kids from pornography. And again, some of the stats on this are terrifying. The largest group of viewers of online pornography is children between the ages of 12 and 17. Among 15 to 17-year-old kids, 80% have had multiple exposures to hardcore pornography. It's just terrifying.
And there are currently, you write, over 4 million pornography websites in operation. And again, 70% ages 7 to 18 old have inadvertently been exposed to online pornography. And you point out that we're not talking about your father's porn. We're talking about a pornography that is significantly more graphic and therefore more harmful, but also significantly more accessible. And the average age, you talked about the people who are watching it, the average age of first exposure is estimated to be 11 years old. And what happens here, it can handicap your ability to be intimate in marriage. If you desire a satisfying sexual experience with a spouse someday, this is a surefire fast track away to ruin that. Studies have shown that habitual users of pornography often need harder and more deviant material over time to achieve satisfaction. Exposure to unhealthy sexual norms in the form of pornography has the potential to permanently imprint sexual deviance on a child's brain. Exposure to unhealthy sexual norms in the form of pornography has the potential to permanently imprint sexual deviance on a child's brain. And so you write, today's pornography has become deviant, vile, and graphic. Young people are witnessing rape, torture, and all kinds of degrading material.
Right. If that's not a wake-up call, I don't know what is. And another thing that Dr. Manning talks about, Dr. Jill Manning, is that a lot of her clients are Christian families. But she thinks that parents really do need a wake-up call about this. They don't know what's out there. They don't know how accessible it is to their kids. Many don't know that their kids might come across it by mistake and then be sort of terrified or really not know what to make of this. And many parents have the attitude that this just simply couldn't or wouldn't happen in their homes. So she advises parents to, first of all, realize that the responsibility lies with them. There's no one out there protecting our kids from pornography. It's up to us. Second of all, she says the parents should talk to our kids. We should let them know that this exists. Depending on your kid's age, however you want to describe it, kids should know this. They can come across this online. They should talk about what their children can do if they do come across it, what they should do, talk to them, come to them as parents. Let's talk about what did you see, and make sure their children know that pornography is not an accurate representation of sex, and that it can turn them away from God's plan for the love between a husband and a wife. There are also, again, we talked about filters in the when we're talking about the chapter about sex. Again, there are excellent filters out there, and I list the highly recommended filters, by pediatricians, psychologists. I think parents are, I think it's just a real mistake not to take pornography seriously and not to install filtering. There was one expert I talked to in this field. He actually works in the field of filtering. And he said he's run across parents who, have the attitude, well, no filter is perfect. And that's true. No filter is perfect. But he said it would be like, not putting your life jacket on your child in a boat just because there's always a chance he would drown anyway. You do everything you can to protect your kids. So use filters. Talk to them. Recognize that this is a big problem. It can impact your children for the rest of their lives. And the responsibility lies with you.
Yes. And this quote, this is a quote from Dr. Patrick Fagan, who's the director of Marriage and Religion Research Institute at Catholic University. Giving a teenage boy a smartphone is installing a porn shop in his pocket, and a very alluring shop it is too. Cheap, free porn, immediately available, and anonymous. It's a bit frightening, I can tell you, that in the confessional, in a general way, that pornography is something in which a lot of people are engaged today. And we're not just talking about soft core porn. It too can be harmful, but in so many ways. Consumerism. We have just 2 minutes before we take our next break. But consumerism, you write, for parents trying to raise children who are grounded in the faith and striving for spiritual fulfillment rather than worldly, living in our material world can be an enormous stumbling block. It's easy to lose sight of what a consumer-driven culture like ours has become and how much that affects our everyday decisions and thinking. You have this quote from Pope Francis, addressed this issue in a Mass at St. Peter's Square, saying, "Whenever material things, money, worldliness, become the center of our lives, They take hold of us. They possess us. We lose our very identity as human beings. That's the close of the quote, and you continue. The pontiff added that when materialism takes over, we, quote, end up becoming self-absorbed and finding security in material things, which ultimately rob us of our face, our human face. Why did you select this particular issue of consumerism as allowing the culture to raise our kids?
I actually had parents ask me to write about this. When I was, you know, putting together the proposal for the book, consumerism isn't something I had, you know, focused on before. It wasn't something I had written on very much. But I had parents come to me and say, this is something that's a huge issue. It's looming. And so I'm glad they did that, because when I looked into it, it is a big issue. And when I think back on, you know, my being a mother, it's especially true with girls, with daughters, the pressure to be a consumer, an ardent consumer, is huge. That's how it came about. People asked me to write about it, asked me to include it in the book. And I'm glad that they did, because it's a big issue.
I'm not going to ask you another question at this point. We're going to continue to talk about consumerism when we come back. And some final thoughts you have in your book. I want to be able to talk about what it is that truly makes us happy. So we will be back to talk about Don't Let the Culture Raise Your Kids. Welcome back to the final segment of Amplify with Marcia Segelstein. We're talking about her book, Don't Let the Culture Raise Your Kids. We had begun to speak about consumerism and how that part of our culture can influence our kids, quote-unquote, raise our kids. And one of the statistics that she speaks about is that America, and this is from her 2014 version of this book, America has more shopping malls than high schools, and for 93% of teenage girls, shopping is their favorite activity. And then consider these staggering statistics about marketing to children, compiled by the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood. Companies spend about $17 billion annually marketing to children, a staggering increase from the $100 million spent in 1983. That's $100 million to $17 billion. Children under 14 spend about $40 billion annually. Compare this to the $6.1 billion for 4 to 12-year-olds spent in 1989. Teens spend about $159 billion. Children under 12 influence $500 billion in purchases every year. And this generation of children is the most brand conscious ever. Teens between 13 and 17 have 145 conversations about brands per week, about twice as many as adults. That's surprising to me. I had no idea.
Yeah, the brand thing is pretty interesting. We and our children are literally bombarded with ads all the time, whether it's on our computers or TV or wherever it is. We're bombarded with ads. We're bombarded with people telling us that, you know, things will make us happy. And on the brand issue, one thing that really I found staggering when I was doing my research was, you talk about teenagers talking about brands. A study found that preschool age can and do understand brands. And this is a quote from this researcher's conclusion. Preschoolers can and do judge others on the basis of brand use. The results show that children as young as 3 willingly judge their peers. They see other children as popular or unpopular, fun or boring, because of the brands they use. Such judgments suggest that at an early age, children attribute great importance to the use of branded products to cultivate and promote self-image. These findings, therefore, seem to flag an early emergence of materialism among preschool children. So that I find frightening and sickening at the same time. Our culture really does foster materialism, so it's just another thing parents need to think about. They need to counter that. They need to work against it. And there are lots of ways that parents can do that. First of all, they can talk about stuff. They can talk about the fact that stuff is not what truly makes us happy and what is truly important. It's important for parents to learn how to say no, to resist the urge to sort of play into the idea that, oh, well, I'll make my child happy. I'll get my child off my back right now by buying them something, because that's sort of feeding the whole consumerism, materialism idea, right? So it's important to bear that in mind, resist the idea of always saying yes. Say no. I've mentioned Dr. Thomas Lacona. He writes a lot about this issue of consumerism, materialism. He says we should help our children realize what truly does make us happy: loving relationships, developing our God-given talents, doing work we can take pride in, growing closer to God in prayer, acts of kindness and helpfulness in our family and beyond. Again, the idea of just talking to our kids about this, like when we talked about discussing peer pressure with our kids, talking about sex with our kids, talk about consumerism. It's a phenomenon. They should know about it. Being aware of it will help them battle it. Dr. Lacona also says that talk about the things that do make us happy. There are things that make us happy. Games that we play together as a family, bicycles that we ride with our friends, books that we read, music that we listen to. But that other stuff isn't what is really going to satisfy us. Another idea of his, which I think is a wonderful one, is cultivating gratitude. We mentioned that once before in this conversation, but I think it's worth mentioning again. He says at our family dinners, which we talked about, he suggests going around the table for what he calls a round of gratefuls, where everybody says something that they're grateful for that day. And he recommends that during bedtime prayers, we also be sure to include what we're thankful for, not just what we're asking for. Another idea of his, which I love, which I write about in the book, is having a family policy of no comparisons. He even suggests making a sign. We talked about the family mission statement, having a sign for that. Put a sign on the fridge door, he says, that says no comparisons. And so we tell our kids when they, because it's just natural, kids are going to compare themselves to other kids. That's what they do. It's just part of childhood. And so when they say, you know, well, so-and-so just got a new pair of sneakers, or so-and-so just got a new pair of jeans, we can point to the sign and say, remember, no comparisons. Comparisons make us unhappy. And this really struck me. He said, we can remind our kids that there will always be somebody who has more than we do. And I just thought that was a very telling thing, to say nothing of the fact that, you know, that most of us in our society, thankfully, many of us, I should say, have an abundance of goods and stuff. And for many of us, the last thing we need is more stuff. And I also address in the book the consumerism when it comes to Christmas, because if there's one holiday that's sort of become a season of getting instead of giving, it's Christmas.
We're hearing about that already. I mean, there's advertisements coming out already. Yes, no, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's just really been taken over by consumerism. I mean, for many people, the first thing they think of when they think of Christmas, even Christians and Catholics, I mean, is what they're going to get is gifts. And that's a sad thing. And there are ways to fight that too. The American College of Pediatricians on their website has some suggestions. Find ways to give back at your soup kitchen or an animal shelter. Have your child go with your child to a volunteer opportunity where they can see other people in need. You know, talk to your children about reaching out to individuals who need help, giving their help to someone as a gift. Tell them to look out for the child in the cafeteria who's sitting by themselves and reach out to them. It opens children's hearts to, it makes them realize that there are people who are lacking really important things. And of course, you know, sharing toys, sharing things with others is an important thing too. Another idea from Thomas Lacona is to consider donating as a family to a charity. And he writes, just considering the possibilities will be an education to them. Just figuring out a list of the organizations that you could, as a family, donate to will open your children's eyes to all the need that is out there. Wow, there are so many groups out there helping people. They probably didn't realize that there are so many people in need. So I think that's a wonderful idea. Start with gratitude for the gift, you know, the gift, yes, that God has given us, and try to give back to others.
And the solution, tip, and tool talk about what truly makes us happy. The quote, we should help our children realize what truly does make us happy: loving relationships, developing our God-given talents, doing work we can take pride in, growing closer to God through prayer, and acts of kindness and helpfulness in our family and beyond. And the suggestion is that it helps if children learn that from their own firsthand experience when possible. And you've just talked about that yourself. And the other three that you didn't touch on were keep advertising at bay, talk before you shop together, and be good role models.
So. Yes, right. I mean, we have to be careful ourselves as parents. We are also drawn into this culture of consumerism. You know, we're all subject to those, advertisements and the lure of stuff to make us happy. If our children see us buying, the latest gadgets, a new car when we don't really need one. If our children see us, discussing, comparing our homes to, so and so had this in their house or something, we have to be good examples to our children. If children witness us focusing on stuff, on consumer things, then they will do that too. So parents need to set a good example when it comes to consumerism, and that can be very tough. We want to give our kids things, something that Bill Doherty talks about in his books is this idea of, say you take your child to a birthday party, right? And it's just this happened to me with my daughter when she was 3 years old. And it's just this extravagant thing, just over the top, way too many kids, way too many presents. But you walk out of there thinking, talk about stuff. I mean, just way too many presents. And you walk out of there thinking, wow, what am I going to do when it's my turn to give a birthday party? So if we keep that in mind and we try not to let that peer pressure, parental peer pressure, get to us, that's an important thing. Having a birthday party in which our kids are going to get 50 presents is probably not a great example to set for them. So parents, we need to be aware of the fact that we can be affected by the lure of consumerism as well. And it's just something to watch out for.
In your final thoughts in the book, again, titled Don't Let the Culture Raise Your Kids, you write, this book is for those of you who made the decision to raise your children as faithful Christians. Hopefully, you've gained some insights into the stumbling blocks you'll run into, how to be prepared for them, how to prepare your kids for them, and how to work around them. Keep in mind that the ultimate goal is to instill the faith. Otherwise, all the protections you put in place, all the precautions you take, all the world-proofing you do, and all the loving, authoritative parenting you demonstrate will be in vain. Your most pivotal role is as primary teachers of the faith. We wouldn't expect our children to grow up understanding the value of being kind to others if we ourselves weren't. The same applies to any virtue: courtesy, honesty, compassion, patience, diligence, humility, self-control, stewardship, and modesty. The best way to instruct children in learning virtue is to live them out with our children as witnesses. Children learn best by example. If they see us being kind, they learn kindness, and so on. And the same applies to faith. And then you have solutions, tips, and tools even for this section. Get help to brush up on your faith. Pray together. Let your children see you praying. Go as a family to church regularly. Be involved in your church and encourage your children to do the same. Start family traditions based on liturgical seasons. Talk about God with your children. Speak a little bit about a couple of these, please.
Yeah. I love the let your children see you praying particularly. And I came across this in a couple of places. One was from the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops on their website. Allow your children to witness you in private prayer, they write. And I think that's a beautiful thing. One of the books that I used as a resource for mine was written by a Christian author, mother, Rebecca Hagelin is her name. And she describes a moment when, as a young girl, she heard someone crying. And so she went upstairs, and her parents' bedroom door was ajar. She peered in, and she saw her father, who was a pediatrician, kneeling at his bed, crying and praying for a young patient of his. She said in an interview, quote, "I stood there in awe of this brilliant man who realized that he needed to go to the great physician for help. That tremendous moment of faith, when he never knew I was watching, impacted me for the rest of my life in terms of where I place my faith." So I think that's it's just something for parents to keep in mind. If our children see us praying, that can be a very meaningful moment for them. Pray together as a family. You know, so many ways to do that. Bedtime prayers for kids, praying graces, saying the rosary together. And a book that was recommended to me on that subject is called A Short Guide to Praying as a Family. And lots of tremendous ideas in there. And being involved in your church and encouraging your children to do the same, that's a really important one. Remember we talked a little bit ago about that statistic about how few Catholic teenagers knew, for example, the church teaching about sex or accepted it. But another statistic that came out of that study was that those numbers changed when teenagers were very involved in their church, when they went to church. When they were involved in the church beyond going to church on Sundays, when at some point during the week on a regular basis they also went to their church, whether it was for a youth group or choir or a teen catechism or something, or saying a rosary, something, the more involved teens were in their church, the more they were, the more they accepted their faith. The more they absorbed it, and the more likely they were to carry it on into later life. So encouraging your children to become involved in your church beyond just going to Mass on Sundays is important. And, you know, another way for parents to encourage that is to demonstrate it themselves, you know, become involved themselves, you know, as lay ministers or singing in the choir or whatever it is, volunteering in some way. Children, you know, can witness that.
What about talk about God with your children. Mm. Why is that so important?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think sometimes it's very easy to say, you know, well, we're off to Mass, we're off to church, we have to go every Sunday. But at some point, at some age, most kids are going to wonder, why am I doing this? Why are we going? And it might not even, they might not even think to ask that question, but maybe when they get to be teenagers or something, they're going to say, wait, I never understood why that was important. So I think that is a critical thing. Children need to understand the reason, the meaning behind going to Mass or to a Sunday service, why it matters. It's not just a family tradition. It's not just a habit. And so, getting back to family traditions and praying in homes and seeing our, letting our children see us pray, if we want our children to be really faithful, we need to help them understand that God isn't just for Sundays. So again, another suggestion from the U.S. Council of Catholic Bishops, talk freely about the presence of God in the joys and sorrows of your life. I end the book with a quote from the Old Testament. I can read it if you want, but basically we should be referring to God all the time. You know, oh, look at that beautiful sky. God's creation is so amazing. Or I'm feeling upset today about the fact that, our neighbor is sick. So I'm going to be sure to say some prayers about that. Talk to kids about your inner life and your prayer life. Those things can be very impactful for children.
And that quote is from Moses to the Israelites. You shall therefore lay up these words of mine in your heart and in your soul, and you shall teach them to your children, talking of them when you are sitting in your house, and when you are walking by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise. Our guest this evening has been Marcia Segelstein, talking about her book, Don't Let the Culture Raise Your Kids. Marcia, thank you so very much for being with us. You've been very helpful.
Thank you, Father. It's been a pleasure.
All right. God bless you and all those you love.
Bless you, too.
All right. Good night. So we've come to the end of the program now, and let me just read part of a quote that she has here. It's Peter Kraft is a Catholic author and professor of philosophy at Boston College. In his book, Before I Go, Letters to Our Children About What Really Matters, is a series of short letters addressed to children and grandchildren. And she explains that in a stream of consciousness style, he talks to them about what he calls the most valuable lessons I've learned. And this is something, of course, each of us could share with our children. There was just a woman on the news who had died and been struggled with health problems for a good part of her life and died as a young woman. But she wrote her own obituary and did pretty much the same thing, excerpts of what she thought were important. And here's her couple that have been selected. We can know God and not just know about him. We can be his friends. He's actually there. And we actually meet him when we pray, whether we feel that or not. And he actually does stuff to us when we pray, whether we feel it or not. Everything that exists, from yourself to a grain of sand, is God's love made visible, made incarnate, love in a form of creation. The words he spoke to create everything in the universe, let it be, were the words of love. He loved stuff into being. Do you wonder what I pray for every day? It's the same thing my Father prayed for me every day. That you should be happy, really, truly happy, and therefore good, since there is no other way to be really, truly happy, and therefore close to God, since he is where all goodness comes from. Don't forget, then, how precious life is and how powerful love is. Tell someone now that you love him or her. Pray for peace, as if it depended on you alone, and come back next Sunday and amplify with us.